a few months, and then I got removed from that school and taken to a wilderness program for troubled teens when I was 16. And then I lived in Montana for 7 months, where I finished my junior year. And then I came back and I finished at Alma Heights. So I did go to quite a few high schools.
So you obviously had an eventful childhood.
Quite eventful. Your son would know as well.
Yeah. Yes, I.
We were friends in high school.
I do know that. Yes. Now, Steve, your childhood wasn't quite so eventful, was it?
My brother and I, I'm a twin.
You're a twin.
We were born in Iowa in 1955. So do the math real quick. I'll be 64 this year. At a year old, the joke is that my brother and I policed the family and sent everybody, and we packed up and moved to California. My dad started a church in Novato, American Baptist Church. And after 5 years, we went from Novato over to over to Benicia. After 5 years there, from Benicia way up north to McKinleyville, and then down to Roseville. So I was a pastor's kid in a large, we had six kids in the family.
Did you behave like a pastor's kid?
Oh,
whatever
well,
that means.
To some, I mean, yes, of course. I can pick up six chairs at one time and move them across a room.
Okay.
I can do tables. We can do all the things that pastor's kids are supposed to do. But of course, our joke is that we were bilingual. We spoke quite a bit differently than we did at home than we did at school. And I don't mean Spanish and English. I mean words that you wouldn't say at home. Yes. And
I'm a pastor's kid too, so I know.
Good.
Yeah.
But for the most part, no, I think my parents are incredible people. They did an amazing job of living out what my father spoke from the platform and what my mother taught in Sunday school. They lived out at home. So the consistency caused me to just follow right along. I accepted the Lord at a very young age, but I don't think I changed that much because we were already living a Christian life. I think my heart started to change slowly, but I think, there wasn't this huge conversion experience for me.
What about you, Jesse? Where did faith fit into your extraordinary childhood?
Yeah. Well, I grew up in the church. I grew up in a vineyard. My dad was a worship pastor for 26 years, so I knew church pretty well. I really loved going to church. It was like my favorite part of the week. I feel the same where I kind of feel like I accepted the Lord probably around seven, like made it like a personal decision. But I feel like over the years I've kind of come back to that and like accepted him at different times in my life more, recognizing the cost more as you get older. Growing up in the church, same thing, like my parents were really consistent, and I think that really helped my brother and I and my sister just like really want to go to church and really want to be involved in that, and all of us are solid believers to this day, so I really, am so grateful that I had that, and also just the upbringing of my parents really instilling the Bible and instilling Jesus into us, even in our schooling and our teaching and stuff. So, yeah, we were very involved in church, and it was a really, really good experience.
How did that fit with the I think you described yourself as a wild child, and you visited a few high schools. How did that, and then went to Montana. How did your faith fit with what was going on with you then?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, I had always like known ever since I was little that like I wanted to know the Lord. Like even when I was a really little kid, like I was always drawn to the Father. But I think as I probably around seven was the age where I started like noticing things about myself, but that are, you don't know what to do. You don't know how to deal with them when you're a really little kid. But I started getting really angry and really depressed. So by the time I was like 11 or 12, I was like full blown, like really, really depressed, very angry. Torment of middle school and my teenage years. back, it was like a constant struggle of just like, you know, where are you? Like, I need you to be here for me. And just always wanting that and always having that as like my deepest desire, but it being somewhat unfulfilled in some sense, just because I didn't really understand who God was at that point, and I didn't really know how to access him, but I always wanted that. And so my parents were like my biggest advocates, and they would constantly be praying for me and pointing me in the right direction. But I progressively went downhill after about 11 years old, like kept going down.
And down.
And down and down and down. Yeah.
And so what point would you say that, would you say there was a point at which you hit the bottom?
I've hit a lot of rock bottoms. I feel like I had a really traumatic breakup when I was about 14 with the man I actually ended up marrying years later. So that was really a point. And then I lost a close friend in high school who died in a car accident. Some of you who live here would know who that was. And so I think when I was 15 was really when I started going downhill. I was doing drugs, so I started smoking pot when I first went into high school, and then within a year I was snorting cocaine, I was taking lots of pills, I was just whatever I could get my hands on, I was doing. And the people I hung out with were all doing that too, so that definitely was brought me to the point where when my parents found certain drugs in my room, they took me to Montana, where I was just, just like literally dropped off on the side of a highway for 7 months at this place with no contact with anyone. So that was pretty rough. That was a rock bottom for sure. Yeah.
Steve, you traversed somewhat less traumatically through your young adulthood and then to college, and
I think till I was 26 and graduated from college, I think that I was a model Christian. I think a lot of people, my mom commented that I was a little bit boring. So she said, sometimes I wish you would do something wrong. But what happened is I got through college, and I don't know whether it was the effect of being away from my brothers and sisters or what, but I kind of surprised myself because I was more successful socially than I thought I would be, and I was more successful kind of just as a leader and those sorts of things. So I came out very, very high.
Yeah.
But high on what I thought I was capable of, what I thought I'd accomplished, and I thought the world was mine.
But now, when you went to school, when you went to college, you went slightly later than, and you had a particularly a characteristic which made you attractive, right?
Well, I suppose I started at a junior college, and after a couple of weeks, I said, this is silly. So I instead went to work in a grocery store, and I worked a million hours, saved up as much money as I could. And when I was 21, I guess, 22, I went to college, 21. And so when I walked in at a mostly residential private school in Southern California, I was like one of the only freshmen that could legally buy beer. So this made me somewhat popular. And even at that, my rule was I wouldn't go to the store until after 9 o'clock. So they would actually wait in the library. So I would be sitting in a chair like this doing my work, and I would look over my shoulder, and there'd be a group standing with their cash in their hands and saying, and then they would go, I'd look around and they'd go, like, we're not going to, because they knew I would say, don't bother me until 9 o'clock. Then at 9 o'clock, one of them would serve as the treasurer. We'd go to the store. And so one turning point, though, that I remember then was one party that I was at. It was a sorority event that I got invited to, obviously. The one of the girls came up to, we were talking, and we were just having a great time, and she looked at me and she said, it's hard for me to say, but she said, I like the drunk Steve better than the sober Steve.
I like the drunk Steve better than the sober Steve.
Correct. And it was on the Queen Mary in Long Beach. We were on the deck. I can remember it. And I think to me, and a lesson is, be careful what you say sometimes because you imprint. You really do. And I don't remember the woman's name. There's nothing else I can recall except for that conversation.
But that conversation changed you.
I don't know if it changed me, but it was something that I kind of felt like it was, and maybe it did. Maybe that was an inflection point where I decided to become the life of the party. And I became very good at it. And it carried me right on through my difficulties at work were usually compensated for by drinks after work. And almost always at the drinks after work, I felt like I had made an impression and that everyone liked me. So that began what I kind of look back as something like 26 years of school, 26 years of fighting for a career.
In which alcohol played a significant part.
Yes, exactly. I use the word career, but it was my whole life. I got out of school. I probably drank 3-4 beers a day for the first 2-3 years, then 4-5 beers a day for the next 3-4 years, and then 6 or 8. At the very end, I was probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 8 to 10 most of the time. I would each morning determine that I wasn't going to drink almost each morning. On the way home from work, I would drive by the 7 or 8 7-Elevens between the BART station in Lafayette and my house in Walnut Creek. And by the time I got, I would say, well, I could stop for 2, I'll just buy 2 beers. And when I go into the store, the 2 and a 6-pack are almost the same price. And when you pick up a 6-pack, the 12s are right next to it. And when you look at the 12s, I would a lot of times actually bring the 12-pack to the counter, and the clerk would even say, for a dollar more, you could have the 18-pack. So this is how a 2-beer problem never goes away, especially if you're like me. If you're sitting next to somebody that drinks a lot of beer, please don't kick them, okay? And don't say, that's you. Say, instead, this was me, and it was highly me, right? And I have a brother who can enjoys his wine, but I cannot. If I drink a beer, I'll drink 6. So that's...
Okay, so I think where we've reached in both of your lives is a point of where you're down there, and we need to begin to come up.
That doesn't happen for a while.
Okay. Okay, tell us more then.
I'll tell you more.
Yeah.
I'd like to say that was where I went up, but I just went farther down after that. So when I was in Montana, I remember I was extremely suicidal for over 10 years, like every day, fantasized about killing myself, thought about all the ways I would do it, really excited for when that day happened. So when I was 15 and I was in this center in Montana, isolated, my parents sent me some new shaving razors, so they allowed me to have them, and I ended up trying to kill myself. So that was a big hullabaloo that happened there. But then I would say, you know, when I came back, I was, you know, fixed, as they said, good enough to go. So when I came back, I immediately went back to cocaine and started doing that all the time. I was blowing through like a gram a day. I had a good job at In-N-Out, so I was spending all my paycheck on drugs. And then I took a year off after high school, and then I was just working, and I went to college in L.A. So I went to a music college there, that was really, I think when I look back, that was probably the turning point of my life where, like, I just was going through hell. Like, I don't think there's really no other way to describe it. Like, I don't even know how you say got. I don't know. I started having an eating disorder when I was about 19, which lasted almost a decade. Actually more like 18. And so I was very anorexic. By the time I got out of college, I was... almost 85 pounds, which is about, you know, I mean, if you can think of that, how small I am now. I was really, really small. And that was really the point where I remember I came home from work one day, and I was 21, and I was sitting in my car, and I was just sobbing and sobbing and sobbing, which was the norm for me, and I had my head on the steering wheel, and I said, okay, Lord, we had just gotten back from Tahoe. We were on a vacation in Tahoe, and I had planned out my suicide in Tahoe, so I was like, okay, this is how it's going to happen. This is what I'm going to do. It's done. It's finalized. And I had decided, and that was right after I had graduated. We went to talk. I think it was the following fall or something. And so I came home, and I was like, okay, I was just like talking with God, and I was like, okay, God, you know, if you're really there, if you can hear me, like, I know you're there, and I don't want to die, but I don't want to live like this anymore. Like, I can't keep going like this. I don't know what the point is. And so I said, you have 1 week. I gave him an ultimatum, which, you know, it worked, right? So, I gave him an ultimatum. I said, you know, you have 1 week. I said, at the end of this week, I'm killing myself. And that's it. So if you can do something in 1 week, then go for it. And, you know, it was interesting because I look back and that week, nothing happened. Like, nothing spectacular, you know, no, like, voice out of the clouds, you know, no angels, like, walking through my bedroom being like, live. The only way I can describe it was, for the first time, like, I had this drop, like, like, if it was just one single flame of hope, like, that was it. Like, I don't know where it came from. I know where it came from, but, like, I don't know. That was all I needed. When you're at rock bottom, like, dead rock bottom, you don't need, you know, God to walk out of heaven. All you need is just one little thing to hang your hooks on. At least that was for me. And so for me, I was like, okay, that one drop, that's enough. I can keep going off of that. And so things didn't really get any better after that, to be honest. In a lot of ways, you know, I think, I don't want to keep, should I keep going or?
Yeah, keep going.
Okay. I had a really traumatic relationship during that time that was really awful. And then I came out of that and still struggling with the eating disorder severely. And I was like, oh, I'm going to go to Europe. I'm just going to plan a trip to Europe. So God kind of hijacked my plans and was very clear and said, no, you're going to go to Europe, but you're going to go to a YWAM base and you're going to do a DTS. And I was like, okay, which is discipleship training school. For those of you who don't know what YWAM is Youth with a Mission. So it's a Christian organization. And it was with the leader of the base was someone who had prayed for me when I was 14 about me having horrible, horrible nightmares, like every night. And they overnight stopped. So I knew that this man was like powerful in a way. Like I knew he had the spirit working in him. And so I was like, okay, I'll go. And that, I think that point when I was 22 was really kind of a pivotal 6 months for me when I went to France and went through a DTS. That was where I really started. I think that's kind of where my relationship with God started blossoming. So,
yeah, I mean, DTSs, my son did one too, as you know. I think I saw you just before you went to France. And, you know, I know that it was pretty transformative for him too. So let's turn to you, Steve, and say, why don't you take us through the period till, you know, things turn for you?
Sure. through those years, I stayed close to the Lord through my drinking times, and I still went to church every Sunday. I actually was the sound guy at my church. I was always there for every work day. I gave faithfully, tried to drag the kids with me whenever they would go, and I got up early each morning and had a quiet time, and most of the time with a headache from being a little bit hungover, or mostly hungover. And it's interesting to me how patient God is with us, because I think through that whole time, I knew that his finger was on that particular part of my life, and then eventually his hand, and eventually he had me, right? But it wasn't so subtle that it was not like I could plead and say, oh no, Christianity has latitude on things like severe alcoholism and things like that. So finally, first marriage failed, second marriage failed. My wife ran off to be with her sixth grade boyfriend, so on and so forth. And she was very ill. It was just really a rough time. And through that whole time, I kept feeling that God was going to make a change. And I kept saying, like her illness, she was bedridden for 2 years. And I would come home each day to try to help her. And I came home for lunch and all. And I kept praying and saying, God, how is this all going to end? Well, I was talking about my wife's condition, not me. And all of a sudden, one day, she came. She was up and walking around, and she said, "I'm going to go to Texas," and she left.
So let's make this clear.
Yes.
So for all of these years, you're going to church. You're doing all of the things that you should do. Everybody who sees you thinks, "Hey, this is a cool. This is a guy walking with Jesus and doing all the things he should do." And yet, at the same time, you're drinking heavily. Is that right? Am I right there?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I don't know. I think in a lot of ways too, it helps me. It helps me because the tip of the iceberg is all we see, right? The top.
Yeah.
And my 90% was in pretty bad shape. So.
And you had two marriages.
Yes.
Children?
Yes. No, from neither marriage, but my second wife brought two kids. I met them when they were 3 and 5. Within a year, I was their father. Their father had disappeared. So
So what was family life like for you?
Actually, it's funny because I was not a sloppy drunk. I was just drunk.
Mm-hmm.
And I was usually remodeling the house or doing something, but I was careful. I never got a drunk driving ticket. I never was drunk at work. Instead, it was when I got home, I opened a beer, and by the time I went to bed at 10 or 10:30, I drank whatever was in the refrigerator. So your
life is sort of like, I go to work and I'm sober. I come home, I get drunk, and I'm building the house.
Correct.
So you didn't spend, yes. So your family life is pretty out of balance.
Right. Sometimes my kids would come out to talk to me, but, and halfway through the conversation, the compressor would turn on and no one could hear each other, that kind of thing. I think I helped them with their homework a little bit, but there's no way that being a father was anything like a priority for me at that time.
Okay, so both of you have now got to the point where something's going to turn. So you go first, Steve. Where does this turn?
So immediately when my wife left, my kids by this time had moved out of the house. They were over 18. I looked up and it immediately occurred to me that everything that I've been working on, that house specifically, and was going to be gone. I knew that a divorce settlement, there's no way I'd carry any of that out. I had an appointment the next day, actually, with a doctor just for my physical, and he said, he says, your blood pressure is mapping increasingly constant, right? It keeps going up every time I see you. And I said, well, so what? And he said, let's talk about your alcohol. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, how much do you drink? And I said, beer or alcohol? And he said, beer is alcohol. And I said, so I was honest with him, and then he said, you're in trouble. And I said, I know I'm in trouble. So I signed up for the 3 days later, I was in a Kaiser 4 nights a week program. That was the beginning. At the same time, as soon as I stopped drinking, then I told my wife, I don't want to sell the house or do anything for a year. I want you to come back. A year later, she didn't come back. She instead was actually, basically she didn't want to come back. So during that year, though, I realized that financially I was going to be decimated. I knew that physically I had to turn around. And then also, I just had to be right with my kids. So I had never adopted them. I did that. I got completely free of alcohol, and again, that's been That'll be 10 years come this June. And I'm not... and I just basically, at that point, I stopped and I looked up and I said, God, if it doesn't get any better than this, which is nothing except my health and my children, I said, this is good. This is good. And so I basically did a very pessimistic life plan for the next, until I was going to die, which included working until the day I died. And I just turned it over to the Lord, said, Lord, this is for you, this is it. And the Lord gave me a verse. He gave me a Joel 2:25, which is that he will give us back the years that the locust took. And I didn't believe it, which was okay. I think God, you know, I don't know that, God, I know that God isn't waiting around for us to accept or not. God, it's still the word of God. And so I just said, fine, I don't believe that's going to happen. I've already mapped out this pessimistic plan, and I'm good. And so that was my next inflection point where I became,
You've accepted.
I would call it, unfortunately, I accepted my fate at that point.
Yeah.
Not the goodness and the grace and the redemption that God had for me. So.
Okay. Jesse, you've come back from DTS. This has begun to change you, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Microphone. Tell us where we go from there.
This will be kind of a tough thing for me to talk about, but so after I came back from DTS, I was on fire, and so I went back actually to staff there. So I staffed for almost 6 months again. So I was in Europe for almost a year total. And the eating disorder that had been anorexia turned into bulimia under the stress of the amount of work that I had to do there. So if you don't really deal with an eating disorder, it just comes back as something else. So for me, I mean, it was like control. I was out of control. I was, you know, it was my coping mechanism. It's an addiction. You know, looking back, you know, I look back and I'm like, wow, out of all the drugs I ever did, out of everything I used, out of all that stuff, like, there was no stronger addiction than an eating disorder for me. And so I was full-blown bulimic. So the eating disorder lasted about 8.5 years total. Then I got married. So I know some of you guys know the story in here about that, or you know some of it. So I married my childhood sweetheart, and we were married for 4.5 years and had a very hard marriage. And he left in June of last year. So that's when I started coming here. I was going to a school, a prophetic school in Vacaville when I was in Vallejo. I lived in Vallejo for 4.5 years with my husband because he went to Cal Maritime Academy. So we moved there. And there were things in me, foundations that were not right, foundational beliefs that I had that were extremely wrong. And this class started really like digging into those and really poking at all of them and really showed me how messed up my belief system was about God, about myself, about other people. And I had some incredible mentors helping me. And so I feel like I started to come out of like where I was, and I almost went into an IOP program where it was like a 5-day-a-week program where you're supposed to go in and they cure you or whatever from bulimia. But you know, I was very stubborn and I was like, no, I'm gonna do it my way. And so I don't know how I got out of that, to be honest. I mean, it was totally God. There was a point where it was really bad. I was losing my hair. I was throwing up blood. Like, it was bad. Like, I was on my way out. I didn't want to live anymore, but somehow came out of that, had a very supportive husband to get me out of that. But, you know, the last 6 months of my life, from the moment David left the marriage and I moved out and moved back here, I think this is the first time in my life where, like, I actually am with God, like, all the time. And, like, he's showed up more than I ever imagined that he ever would. And all the longing and all the desires from the last, you know, 3 decades from me as 5 years old, 7 years old, just crying out to him. It's like all of that is finally being, like, restored. Like, this is the last 6 months has been the relationship that I've always wanted with the Lord. But there was no way to get me there unless I was at rock bottom. And, you know, I'm sitting up here and I am at rock bottom. Like, I have never been so low in my life. I have never been so wanting to die. You know, to be honest, there are days where I just wake up and I'm just like, I don't want to be here right now. I want to be with you. Like, this would be so much better if I was with you than what I'm going through. But I look back and I'm like, just even on the last 6 months and the ways that the Lord has spoken to me so profoundly is just wrecking. Like, to look back and see that he set this all up, that the last 6 months is a part of his mercy over my life, because what he's doing in me is he's fulfilling the desires of my heart, which was to know him. And so I feel so grateful, you know, for these 6 months. And I know it's not over. I know there's still a lot that I am going to have to go through. But for the first time in my life, I'm like, you know, I don't really care anymore what happens, in a sense, because it's like I've already lost everything. So all I have to gain is Jesus. You know, like, there's nothing better to gain. And so just I'm so thankful for where God's taking me and how profoundly he's speaking to me and the ways that he's changing me and teaching me how to love myself, because I've never been able to do that, teaching me to trust him that this is part of his, like, this is all part of his plan, that he set this all up for my benefit, and to just trust him that he's got the best in mind for me.
And I have to say, we're extraordinarily privileged to be just a small part of witnessing God doing these things in your life. And we're really appreciative for you for being as open and as vulnerable as you have been with us as a church family. So thank you so much for that. It's taken a lot of courage, I know. I really appreciate that. Now, Steve, you hit rock bottom, and you had accepted your fate. But what happened there?
It wasn't immediate, obviously. And I think to Jesse's story as well. I think there's a period that where you just find yourself much more in relationship with your Maker than you ever thought possible, because that's about all you've got. My family was very, very helpful, because I still live near my parents and my brother there as well. And I think I was ready. I think after 26 years of making a mess out of my life, I was patient and ready to just kind of let it come back together. I think then God slowly got me into the job I needed to be into. I think that eventually God helped me to meet my wife Amy now, and then also just to kind of settle down a little bit and become more of a more focused on what God has for me than what I want for myself. I think some really good teaching says that God's more interested in our character than in our comfort. And I think in 26 years, I was much more seeking my comfort than my character. And I think alcohol was how I was doing it. And I think as a result, I missed all the character development that God had for me during those 26 years. And so I'm way behind. I got a lot of time to make up for. And that's what I think for 10 years now, I've been really trying harder to just try to find myself in the spot where I think God wants me. And I think to Jesse too, I think I am a testimony to the fact that God is in the redemption business. That restoration is his business. That if he walks into a room and a chair is laying over, God would flip that chair up and make it right. And I think, fortunately, Amy's not here this morning, my wife. If you spend a few minutes with her, you'll know what a gift she is to all of us. But to imagine being married to that woman it really just humbles me. Also, my kids have been just tremendous. And with Amy, I ended up with two more kids from her previous marriage. And then together we have four grandkids. We have another one on the way this month. And God's blessing has just been amazing. The job that I ended up with and where I work now, I was last year in all over the U.S. as well as in Paris and Madrid doing work, but also still had the freedom because it's a good company to tour and to do other things. Amy came over when I was in Madrid. So a lot of those things that I would think would be the lifestyle of the rich and famous, which I never intended to be based on where I was 10 years ago, and I'm still not, obviously. God has just blessed me so much. He gives me so many things. He gives me so many opportunities and things that I had just, in my pessimistic 10-year plan, I would have never seen. And again, I think to let God write your future is the only way to write your future. If we do it, we cut ourselves so short. So.
Well, I think that's a good point for us to conclude our interviews, because both of you leave us in a place where we see not just what has happened, but what the possibilities and what that God hasn't finished yet, any more than God has finished with any of us yet. And so I invite you now to show your appreciation to these two people who've been extraordinarily vulnerable, and we are so grateful to you for that. But then to move into the fellowship hall, to gather around these tables and begin to ask yourself, what are the things that I've heard them say mean to my life, mean to the things that God might be saying to me, the things he might be challenging me to change, the things that he might be wanting me to look at in a new way. So thank you so much for doing this. And the doors are there, that you'll just take a number, they'll find a table, and let's go. Terrific.